listener production.
Shares. Market. The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is, well, frankly, reeling. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, of course, is the managing director, the founder, the chief cook and bottle washer, the employee of the month, I'm reliably informed, at Strawman.
24 months running.
Mr. Page, how are you?
I'm my jaw is on the floor, mate. Like, this has been a wild week.
Last week.
Yeah.
Mate, but before we go to that, though, if you are employee of the month, you should know what strawman.com is, I assume.
I should. And that's part of what gets me the honor each month.
Hey. But
we're an online private investment club.
I'll tell you what. No wonder you get the award, mate. That must go well at company meetings.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get past it. We can I tell you, more people again during the week said they liked the joke. I'm sorry to those who don't like the joke. I'm sorry to you. I'm not really sorry to you. I'm kind of chuffed myself, but you know, it is what it is. So it may hang around, mate. Jaw on the floor. It's really so. Actually, you know what I'm going to start with is, God knows what happens next, and we're recording this on Thursday morning.
Yeah.
So you know, like doing a podcast that comes out 36 hours later is tough at the best of times. In a week like this, I don't know. So,
yeah.
Listeners, as of I will literally timestamp this. We're recording at 9:19 a.m. on Thursday morning. It's 9:19 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, just in case something happens in the next hour and you're in Queensland or somewhere else. It's been a big week.
Yeah.
So let's rewind a million dog years, but 7 days to SVB, the Silicon Valley Bank that most people had never even heard of, which goes from, things might be a bit of trouble to, hey, can we have $42 billion, please, to the Fed's taking it over all in the space of one business day.
Yeah.
18th biggest US bank. The banker of choice for most of the tech sector. I don't even know where to start with this one, mate. Let me try and lay out what I think I know.
Yep.
You can tell me where I'm wrong and then you can add some thoughts. So bank runs are as old as time, as old as banks anyway. And it comes down to, if you think your money is safe at the bank, you leave it there. When you lose confidence, when you lose faith, when you think maybe it's not as safe as you thought it might be, you take your money up. And when everyone does that, you cause the very thing you're worried about, which is a stampede at the bank branch. And the simple reality is that if you are a bank, you take my money and Andrew's money, you put it in the at-call accounts and pay us 0.0001% interest. And then you lend that money and some extra to people who want to borrow that money, whether it's businesses for 3 or 5 year rolling loans generally, or mortgage loans for 30 years. And you figure that overall, if you kind of look at the flows, you're going to have enough money in the bank and enough deposits coming in regularly enough that you can meet the usual types of withdrawals. The average kind of daily withdrawal, you leave a bit more buffer just in case. But you know that in a steady state, you're in a good place. When your depositors all say, actually, we would all like our money back right now. And you say, well,
it's not here. It's in Bill's house and it's in Fred's farm. And
what's that from? Somebody told me.
There's a movie called A Wonderful Life.
That's right. A Wonderful Life.
And there's a bank run in that.
Yes.
And I forget the actor's name. Very famous actor. But yeah, it's
Jimmy Stewart.
No, might be. I don't look. Anyway. Before my research, we're old, research. But we're not that old. So it is before our time. But it is such an iconic scene. It gets quoted all the time.
It is Jimmy Stewart, by the way.
Jimmy Stewart. Okay. So yeah. These are very. By the way, this was the original impetus for creating central banks.
Yes, which kind of gets us to the next stage in the process. Now, I will say, Silicon Valley Bank. Part of the problem was the bank run. That is the entire problem. What causes the run, though? And this is where we'll talk a lot about confidence this episode, mate. With a capital C.
Can I just finish off your thought there, just to really underline that this is what you're describing is what's known as fractional reserve banking.
Yes,
and that means that the money's just not there. It's not there. So
it will be there over time, but it's not there right now.
I think we tend to assume that when there's this antiquated notion that I take my money to the bank, they pop it in a vault and it's just there.
Yes.
And then, you know, when you want it back, it's it. But it's literally not there.
And I think everyone kind of knows that, but you don't really ever think about that until you're forced to confront it.
And I'll also say maybe we could probably be a bit more forgiven for it in Australia because it just hasn't happened in forever.
Yeah.
But in the US, they on average, I think they have two or three every year. Yeah. There's much bigger. There's a lot more banks over there. It's actually a very common thing in the modern era.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what happened on the was it Thursday night our time, I think, from memory.
As you say, a million years ago now.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, but what caused the run, and again, causes is in air quotes, but effectively what happened was Silicon Valley Bank was run badly. And when enough people knew / believe that to be true, confidence ebbed away. Once confidence ebbed away, you start the panic, you start the bank run.
Egged on by VCs on Twitter.
So this is the first big bank failure of the social media era, right? So, I mean, there's something to that as well. But yes, I mean, that's part of it. So you end up with a situation where the bank was badly run. They had, if we go back to 2008 in Australia, Wizard Home Loans and Aussie Home Loans effectively went broke, had to be taken over. Because what they did is they got their, we're talking about durations, we're talking about cash in the bank, as depositors, that's effectively the way Wizard and Aussie will run. They use revolving short-term lending to give long-term loans. But when you have that revolving lending, it needs to revolve, it needs to replenish itself every month. Mm. Effectively, when there was a credit squeeze, a credit freeze in the GFC, the lenders went, well, you can't have our money anymore. Mm-hmm. And Aussie said, well, hang on, I've got these loans out to the mortgages and I'm relying on you rolling this loan over, otherwise I've got to pay the whole loan back. So when you roll over a loan, effectively, rather than saying it's a 30-day loan, right? It's due at the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the month, you can either pay it all off or continue to have that loan outstanding and just pay the extra interest. That's what normally happens.
Or just borrow money from somewhere else to pay off the other loan, as you say, roll it over. Yeah.
And when you can't roll it over, it's all due. So end of the month comes, Aussie had to pay up everything they owed. And again, it's in Bill's house, it's in Fred's house. Mm-hmm. The Wonderful Life, we should have a podcast viewing of A Wonderful Life, but we'll do that another time.
Director's commentary.
Exactly. Yeah, I want financial commentary over it. That'd be pretty cool. Yeah. That's super nerdy, but it'd be fun. Anyway, so yes, basically that's what happened during the GFC is they couldn't roll it over and it was all due and effectively they had to sell themselves to the big banks so they could use their funding. Now, fast forward to today, it's a little bit different for Silicon Valley Bank, but not heaps. They had basically, instead of a timing issue, it was a cost issue. They had assumed when they made their promises that they would always be able to get cheap funding because rates would stay low. We all know over the last 18 months, interest have gone through the roof, which has increased their costs, but didn't increase their revenue. So they had rising costs. And remember, bank margins are less than 2%, generally speaking. So if the official interest rate goes up by 3% and you can't increase your revenues because you made long-term promises to people, then you have a squeeze. And that was effectively, again, tell me if you have a different view, mate, but my understanding is that's effectively what caused the problem. There wasn't an issue with the value of the assets themselves. The loans were going to get repaid. There wasn't an issue with the timing. That was all fine. The issue in this case was that the timing became the issue. But the issue was people who had their money in the bank went, hang on, this thing's going to go broke because it's got this mismatch between its costs and its revenues. If it goes broke, we lose our money. Quick, let's get it out. That starts the bank run. And if you're staying with us, that's what caused the bank to be shut down in less than 24 hours.
And what also is different today, a bank run involves pulling your phone out of your pocket and pressing some buttons.
Yeah, that's right.
So before, there was actually an advantage in having to go in and see a teller and join a massive line is that they could kind of help slow. So there was something like $4.5 billion an hour over that on Thursday. Yep.
$42 billion in total they wanted.
$4.2 billion an hour over business or whatever it was. And as you say, it's the largest bank run in modern US history. $16.7 billion over 10 days or something. The numbers are mind boggling. I'll give a little bit of extra color here. It's worse than that because what they did, they didn't, normally a bank can hedge its interest rate risk. Correct. So if it moves around, you've taken out insurance for a cost, but it means that you avoid this kind of problem. And they didn't have any risk management, not very good risk management. The other thing is that with a lot of their money, with their assets on their balance sheet, they put it into ostensibly the safest investment in the world, which is US Treasuries.
Yes.
Now, a consequence of official interest rates going up so much is that bond prices fall. It's an inverse relationship. So if I sell you a bond, $100 face value, and it pays $1 a year as a coupon, as an interest rate, and then interest rates drop, sorry, interest rates increase. They go from 1% officially to 2%. Now, anyone out there who's looking to get a yield is like, why are you going to buy, if you wanted to sell the bond I just gave to you, why would they buy it off you at face value, getting a 1% yield?
So now, they're going to get the full value back eventually, but again, it's a timing issue. They couldn't liquidate it in the short term because the face value, or the market value had fallen.
So the market adjusts. So if you were to sell that bond, people would say, well, I want a lower price, so I'm getting the same yield as that I effectively could get on a new bond. So there is more than a small amount of irony here in the world's safest investment. The way that the maths works is that when you have interest rates going up 3% in an incredibly short period of time. So I think the US 10-year dropped 40% in face value, close enough, might have been 38%, something like that. So the world's safest investment, down 38%. So when they went to sort of say, okay, we need to free up some cash, they tried a capital raise at one point, by the way, and that
I do. Can I just add quickly? I want to go back to the face value thing, because as people are listening to this, it's not the U.S. Treasuries were worth 40% less in terms of their actual face value. You were always going to get your money back. There was no question of the full faith and confidence of the U.S. government. Yep. But it was simply a case of, if you wanted to buy and sell them on the market, trying to sell someone a low interest rate product when they could buy a high interest rate product from somebody else means there was no market for them.
That's a secondary market, it's called.
Yes, exactly. Yep. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and it's all good and well to say, I was like, well, I'm just going to wait. And if you're on a 6-month or 1-year T-bill or something like that, well, it's probably not that big a deal. If you're on a 10-year, that's a long time to wait to get your full value back. And
right. God, assuming you wanted or needed to sell it in the meantime. I mean, a lot of people would have bought it for that 10-year return. Yes. But if you want the money in the meantime, you go to the bank, redeem your term deposit, you might get nothing in interest, or they might whack you in straight and say, well, okay, you can have it. You're not supposed to, but okay, here it is.
Yep.
But if you've got to sell it in the open market, then it's a very, very different story. Yeah.
It's crazy. And oh man, there's so many layers to this. So I'm sorry for going all over the place. But there's accounting rules here that you need to be aware of as well. So when they buy these assets, they have to mark them as either available for sale, AFS, or HTM, held to maturity, which basically says our intention here is to hold it to maturity. When you do that, as far as the accounting rules are concerned, that just carries on your balance sheet at the face value, regardless of what happens on the secondary market. If it's available for sale, which is, we have this available, as it says on the tin, available for sale, you have to do what's called mark to market. So if the market price of those bonds fall, you have to write that down on your balance sheet, and over on the profit and loss statement, that counts as a loss. So SVB, and by the way, probably more than just they're not isolated. There's a lot of banks with this toxic paper on their books. Mm-hmm. They had to write all this stuff down, but there's a whole bunch, people aren't idiots, right? So people go, yeah, I know that it's not on the numbers yet, but this value that you've got in HTM bonds is not worth what you think it's worth. And that leads to the confidence issue, that leads to the deposit withdrawal issue, that leads to the liquidity issue, and then that leads to the Fed or the authorities having to step in. And is there more to say on the what happened before we talk about the policy response?
We'll probably do Credit Suisse separately, I suppose, because it's a similar but different story.
We'll get
to Credit Suisse in a minute. Go on.
And this is the thing that's worth underscoring here. You said the 18th largest. I heard the 16th largest. Okay. We're splitting hairs. This is a very major financial institution, right? So the problem is that depositors might not get their money back. There is an FDIC scheme, which is effectively insurance. It guarantees that up to $250,000 worth of deposits, if a bank goes under, that's insured. You'll get that back.
Yes.
Most customers had well more than that because, as you said, there are a lot of Silicon Valley companies in there, some of them pretty flush with cash after years of free money, essentially. So they had a lot of sort of cash that's sort of sitting there.
I will disclose quickly while you take a breath, just for full disclosure, The Motley Fool was a depositor at Silicon Valley Bank, no longer because the bank doesn't exist. The money's been made good and we're apparently fine. Most more than that's confidential, and obviously we don't need to go into the details, but just for everyone's full knowledge, we also have recommended Silicon Valley Bank in the past as an investment. So I'll get those two disclosures out of the way just because people deserve to know. I don't think it impacts my view. It certainly doesn't impact your view, but again, disclosure is always better than non-disclosure. disclosure. So there's the transparency.
Well, very quick aside. Jim Cramer, who a lot of people will know, he's the guy on Mad Money over in the US.
Yeah,
he is probably there's a Twitter account called the Inverse Cramer, and basically, and there's actually an ETF. This is not a joke. There is an ETF called the Inverse Cramer as well, where it basically just does the opposite of what, and it's based on the fact that this guy's made just notorious call, like by Lehman Brothers before, you know, 3 days before it went bankrupt. He put a buy on SVP like last week or something.
Oh dear, okay.
Here's another thing. Moody's rated at AAA last week.
Yeah.
Right. So if you haven't watched The Big Short, watch The Big Short.
Yes, exactly.
But essentially, don't take what the ratings agencies say. They're absolutely captured. This is the tinfoil hat going on here. But I think at a point we can say this with a straight face. And we've seen exactly what's happened. And this is AAA in your view, guys? Okay, thanks. We'll take a
reminder too that Moody's downgraded Berkshire from AAA to AA at some point in the past. Maybe it's deserved, but in a relative sense, if you've got a AAA rate, Silicon Valley Bank and AA Berkshire, and Berkshire Hathaway, this is I own shares, as everyone knows, Warren Buffett's company. It's a
mountain of cash, by the way. It's absolute pure madness. It's clown world, frankly, is what it is. So anyway, so your deposits are gone now if no one does anything. And
above the FDIC insured limit.
Yeah, above you, yes. And for most of them who have got $10 million in the bank, that's not a lot for a company, right? There's plenty of companies that had heaps more than that. So I think it was something like, I forget the percentage, but 80% or something of funds weren't insured. So on one hand, you could look at that and go, well, that sucks. That's fractional reserve banking. That's the risks. You took it. The trouble is that there's something like 16,000 companies in California, as you say, largely concentrated in the tech space, that now can't pay payroll, that now can't pay their invoices. So there you have a contagion, which could be, so just basically lead to mass layoffs and all kinds of damage there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then there's also the other contagion of other people going, whoa, if this can happen here and other banks have, you know, under this, it just spreads through very quickly. The money's just not all there, right? Mm-hmm. The amount of quote unquote money that's sort of out there in the system actually isn't there if everyone calls it back at once.
Correct.
Which is why the authorities have stepped in.
We should say cash really, because if the assets are valued correctly, then the value is there. Yep. The capital M money, or I don't know which one's capital M actually. It doesn't really matter. Yeah, the value is there. I've got $100 deposited in a bank, and that bank's loaned out that $100 to back a mortgage. The house is there. And this is the thing with Silicon Valley Bank is there was no problem with their assets. The assets themselves were largely, I think, we never say entirely, right? Banks always have failed assets, but they were largely, you know, there's no problem with the asset quality or even the asset value. There was the mark-to-market stuff you mentioned with the treasury bonds, but over time, that money comes back. If you add it all up and say, is there value here to offset the deposits? Yes. Mm. But, you know, is it all available in capital M money or little M money? Capital C cash probably is better way to put it. Then no, it's absolutely not there. And you're absolutely right. That is fundamental. I mean, it's banks generally, right? They lend me money to pay someone else to buy a house, which is no longer money, on the basis I'm going to give them back little bits of that money over 360 months. The money isn't there. The house is there. My income is there. I will probably pay the house off. Most people will probably pay the house off. But that gap is always true. As you say about the other stuff, we don't think about it until you get to this situation where you go, but where's the money? It's like, well, it's everywhere and nowhere. And that's why bank runs are a thing.
It is such an incredibly deep rabbit hole. When you say, I don't even want to go there, but when you say what is money, that is a much more difficult question.
Yeah, it is.
When you think about it, right? And generally speaking, in international markets, and that's actually the debt itself is the money. You know, people will use these notes and papers and reverse repos and all this. It's just, again, turtles on turtles and stuff. But is it money? Well, it acts like money. You know, you could say a house is money in a lot of ways. You know, so it's very diabolically sort of complex. The other part of it is too is that there is, even without a lot of these issues, so deposits are a major source of funding for banks. It's not just sort of like a little bit. It's a lot. It's the majority amount. And for the reasons that you said, you pay depositors bugger all, and you get to lend it out at much higher rates. Now, if I'm a company and I've got $20 million, some companies have billions of dollars, right, in cash, and it's at the bank who's paying me bugger all, why wouldn't I just put it into a money market fund or a T-bill directly? And by the way, these days, I'm getting a really good interest rate on that for less risk. where's my incentive to leave the money in the bank? I mean, I need a bit for transaction services and day-to-day kind of facilities.
Right.
But I don't need my $10 million sort of sitting there. Mm, mm. So there's also a risk too that just sort of drains the system a little bit too.
Correct,
of funds.
Correct. And with no alternative. And by the way, it also then, and you're right, it's all around. At some point, it's also turtles. At some point, it's also the question of where else do you put the money then? Because you either spend it or you invest it, air quotes, somewhere else, which may or may not be more or less risky than money in the bank. And there are, I think this is why this is such a difficult question, because there's the people. So there's, do we save the people who put their money in the bank? Do we save other banks from their counterparty risk? Do we save the system? Do we save confidence in financial flows? I mean, at some point, you're back to Cobb and Co. coaches carrying gold bars around, right? So you know the money's there. Fractional reserve banking. Do you take that away? I mean, these.
What's the solution here? Yeah.
Right. And this is where we get to least worst outcomes in my mind. And you and I have had a bit of a chat on Twitter. I've had a chat with some other people on Twitter. You end up in least worst solutions where I think, and the challenge for me, and I'll kind of put my chin in a bit and share a view, and then you can jump all over it. The issue for me is there's a whole lot of ideology around, particularly on Twitter, but just around in general.
Particularly,
people say, "Well, this should be true because this should be right."
Yes.
And in a perfect world, this would be true and this would work. And I have a heap of time for that, because there is a lot of, we should be spending a lot of time thinking about the best way to do things and from first principles. So that's, I did my super on first principles the other week. We should do that. Rather than, hey, how would you slightly change what we've got? It's like, well, if you didn't have it, what would you do? That's really important.
Yep.
But then I always, always, always fall on the simple question of, which is the least worst outcome when you measure the impact? When you measure the effects, which is the least worst? Not because any of them are good, not because any of them are capital R or air quotes right, not capital R, that feels like a right-wing thing. Not because anything's correct, let me use better terms just to make sure I don't stray anywhere. You know, is there a more correct solution? Yeah, absolutely. I've said this about financial advice a million times. You know, the only good advice is the advice that's taken. I can give someone the absolute best mathematical, expected value calculated advice, and they go, yeah, nah. Or I can say, hey, just go and do this. Oh, okay, I can do that. So which is the best advice? Well, technically, one is theoretically better. I get better marks on the exam. The other is worse, but end up with people with better outcomes. Well, which one's the best advice? Now, I think in that case, it's reasonably straightforward.
Yep.
Very, very difficult when it comes to this, because there are counterfactuals and there are expectations. There are a whole lot of things. What's the price of a bank failure? What is the cost of the, you know, we saw, we just talked about the credit freeze during the GFC. And that was actually with central bank activity, right? So imagine the GFC, then multiply it by something if nothing gets done, or next time if nothing gets done. It's an absolute mess.
Yep, you're right. Let's play that through, right? So let's say we'll talk about what the Fed did and other policymakers, because it's really interesting and noteworthy and somewhat historic in the response that they did take. But let's say they didn't do anything. So what you then have is all of a sudden, you know, tens of thousands of companies unable to meet payroll, billions of dollars in deposits wiped out, lots of shareholders go to the wall. Okay, that sucks in that area, and that's actually a big deal in and of itself. But then we see it playing out in other banks. It was like, well, if I only get 250K insurance, I'm going to take anything above that out. I'm going to put it somewhere else. So you just have a liquidity drain on the entire market. Plus, you just have incidences with confidences and stuff. It throws all asset values around. It gums up the financial system. There's just no liquidity available anywhere. Debts can't get repaid, and it just spirals out of control. It could, very realistically, it sounds a bit doom and gloomish, but if they didn't step in and do something, it could have led to a very bad and brutal recession. It still might, frankly, but that's. That is why it's the least. I'm with you there. It's the least worst option, because if I was over in the US and had any say on things, I would have bailed out to some degree as well. So I guess I'm with you there. Where I disagree with it is that I think that we quote unquote fix an issue, but we then don't change any system. So then you're then you have all these unintended consequences.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So should have we bailed out, or we, should have the US bailed out SVP? And some people say, well, it's not technically a bailout. We'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Let's do that.
What the response is. But I would have done it because of all those things it said. But then I think at that point you say, we've got to change some of the rules here, and we have to give some other alternatives to depositors. The reason being is it creates what they call moral hazard. Again, watch The Big Short, right? This is the problem. It's always a question of incentives, right? Show me the incentive, I will show you the outcome. It's the Charlie Munger quote, which is just so spot on with everything. So all of a sudden, I know I'm going to be backstopped by the US government. What am I going to do? I'm going to take more risks. Even if I'm the kind of person who's a bit more prudent, my competitors are probably going to do it. It's game theory, right? Someone is going to start doing it, and it's going to be incentivized to do it because there's advantage in it. And that will draw us all towards that stuff, and so on and so forth. And on we get past this, and when we stumble onto the next crisis in which everything gets bailed out. And let's remember here, these losses are real. Like people have lost money. So when you say, oh, it's okay, the Fed's going to come in and bail them out, there's a cost to that.
Kinda.
Well, we should get to the response here.
All right.
And I will argue for what that might be. But I guess what we were sort of talking about in Twitter, my point was that this is a fascinating side story. But years ago, there was a bank called the Narrow Bank, and they came up with a new business model. There's another one called Custodia, run by Caitlin. I forget her last name now. You know,
Custodia sounds almost Handmaid's Tale. It's like some sort of weird country called Custodia.
Bit funny.
I should have chosen a better name, I think. But keep going.
So the business model is this. So traditional banking, I take your deposits, as you've already described it, and I lend it out to other people. They're saying, no, we're not going to do that. We are purely transaction services and custodial services. Right. So when you deposit your money with us, we don't lend it out. We actually deposit it with our bank, which is the central bank. We put it into reserve. So it's the safest thing. Now, why would you do that? You're not going to make nearly as much money. And they're like, yep, that's cool. It's a different model. And we're targeting a different clientele. The value proposition with banks traditionally is put your money with us. We'll give you some transaction services. We'll keep it safe. Stop sniggering. And you'll get interest on that. You'll earn interest. And this is what we're all taught at school. Put your money with the bank, save up. That's the prudent, sensible thing to do. Compound interest, blah, 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 blah. They're saying, no. We're not going to do that. You're not going to get any interest with us. In fact, you might even have to pay us a fee. The value prop is you can do everything you want with your money and it's full reserve. Now, you might say, well, that's not for me. I'm perfectly confident in most of the banks, and thank you very much. I'd prefer a 1% yield on... That's cool. But the regulators have knocked this back multiple times. You think, well, what's the harm in that? What is the harm in if someone wants to do that? It's not risking the system. In fact, it's linchpinned on the foundation of the entire global financial system, in that it's held at reserves in reserves at the Federal Reserve. So it's sort of bizarre. And then when you think about it, the reason is they said, well, if you have something like this out here, and then you have some banking crisis, what does everyone do? Everyone takes their money out and they put it in these kinds of things, and it risks all the others. So it's kind of like, hey, this would be a really good idea, except that it undermines this entire fractional reserve system when things go wrong.
That's kind of my point, is that the health of the system that underpins everything that we do as a society, that's why I think in terms of the least worst outcomes rather than the first principles ideology of which would be, would this be safer for the individual? Well, probably actually not, because we know the government's going to backstop us. But that take that aside, you know, is this an interesting idea? Yes. Is it a net positive for the financial system or a net negative? And when I say financial system, I want to be really clear. I'm talking about the banks, right? I don't give a shit. Don't give a stuff. I don't own any bank shares. I never have. I don't think. I had some Macquarie at one point, I think. I genuinely don't care, right? So when I say the system, I don't mean the cabal of bankers and their, you know, their champagne and caviar lunches. I mean the thing that allows you and I to believe that we can live our lives and be reasonably prosperous as a society because we have a trusted way to interact and transact.
Yeah.
So
this change that though? I can still the system
for the,
is
for the very reason you said, that as soon as the money moves, it's the so what, right? Unless you're going to prevent bank runs, this makes them more likely.
You know what I think it does? Exactly,
go on.
No, I think what it does is it puts into stark contrast the implicit bargain that you make here. So let's reframe things. When you put money at the bank for them to look after it, actually what you're doing, and this is literally true, is that you are actually providing the bank a low interest loan. That's what you're doing.
Yes.
This is the lesson from crypto, which is like the 100th time that this happened. Whenever there is a yield,
yeah,
there is risk. Full stop, period.
Well, keep going.
So why is it that you get an interest rate when you put your money into a savings account? It's because they're able to, as we just said, they're able to earn a better rate of return.
Yes.
Pay you, and it's there to attract your money. It is a source of funding. Now,
100%.
In a new world that I'm imagining from my first principles ideological standpoint,
yep,
we have a system where you can, as a consumer, as a business, you can say, look, I don't want interest or much interest, and I'll just leave it through this bank that deposits via the Fed, or I'll take a little bit of risk and I'll get interest. Now that's an absolute choice. Once you take that choice, though, and banks know that, well, you're not going to get bailed out if this happens, I think risk management changes, the incentive structure changes, and I actually think you've still got what you've got today, because a lot of people will opt into this. I probably would too, certainly up to like 250K. Like, why wouldn't I? I don't want to make out that this is hyper, hyper risky. It's not. People have been keeping their money in ANZ and Westpac and whatnot for years. You could absolutely do that. I don't think there'd be a mass exit to like this zero interest rate kind of product.
Except that, to your point, at the point in time which there is some sort of fear, in which case you create a correlated bank run across the entire financial system, because at this point, when confidence is lost, without the ability to or willingness to restore that confidence, you make people, this is SVB squared, right? That's exactly why the regulator stepped in the first place, which is if with SVB fail, they don't want to take some money out of everything else that might possibly fail, and you create this enormous catastrophe we just talked about.
Yeah, but think about it.
Anytime you don't provide that sort that confidence, You undermine the system and create this multi-year recession with 15% unemployment or whatever else happens because you chose not to step in. That's the trade-off.
This is what you're saying to citizens. You're saying if you've got any money,
yep,
you can take it in cash, put it under the mattress, be at risk of fire or theft or whatever, or certainly just going to be eroded away massively by inflation. So you can do that if you want. You can put it in cash. It's a liability of the central bank itself, you know, or you can put it at a bank. Oh, by the way, the bank will lend your money out and you've got no say in it. What they do, we have to rely on trust, but we are forcing you to put it there. Now, it's
not forcing you. We're allowing you to put it there if you don't choose not to have it in cash or put it in the backyard. So we're not forcing you to do anything.
Okay, but it's a pretty ordinary choice though, right? Like keep it in bags of cash under your house. Yep. Or put it in the bank, and there's no, you're not allowed to do anything else with it.
Sure.
And in a system, this isn't me making it, demonstrably goes from failure to failure to failure to failure. But we're going to force you to participate in that because of quote unquote the economy. And I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I think the problem is that banks know, for all of the reasons that we just discussed, that there is absolutely no downside to the people running these things if things go really bad, because you either get a bailout or at least you get your golden parachute and you kick out. And it's just, and surprise, surprise, that's why we have all of these issues. In a world where there is some choice there and people know that you actually won't be bailed out and there are much better regulations for one, that's something I think we can both agree on.
Totally.
Is that you don't have a perfect system, but I think you have one that is far more resilient to shocks. And one that is just far less of a devil's bargain, where it's just sort of like hold a gun to people's head and say, you've got to lend money to the banks. You have to lend money to the banks.
Except that there's no downside.
And expose yourself to risk. That's exactly what's happened. There's massive risk.
No, there's not because this would be the depositors were made whole. So you, in your
version, after they changed the rules, and we've got to get to what they did. But
your version of the world says this is more ideologically pure, and if there are bank runs, so be it. At least I wasn't forced to put my money in the bank, right?
Yeah.
So the trade-off is I don't care what happens to the economy as long as I'm not forced to put money in the bank. I reckon at a societal level, that is a far, far, far worse outcome than. You're not forced to, but let's go with that.
You are. Line. You're forced to. There's no other option.
You can put your money wherever you want. You can put your money wherever you want. You can put it in a safe deposit box in the bank if you want.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be deposited.
But okay.
No, but they can. They can. Why couldn't they?
Okay.
So you're not forced to do it. But in doing so, the system says it's in the best interest of the society that we are in to have a flow of capital that is allowed by our banking system. And the cost of that, and you're right about better regulation, right, which is the so what. So we'll agree on that and get to that. But the so what for me is, okay, the deal is that in making the financial system better, the risk is every now and again, a government entity has to administer a program that stops bank runs. Mm. And that's and you're, is it a devil's bargain? Sure, call it what you want. Do, which if I get to live in either country, if you create if we get a Mars, right, and Elon says, I'm going to have your version of the financial system, or you say that they have my version of the financial system, I'm saying here, I'm not going, or conversely, I'll go to Mars to avoid it. Because when there is a next time there is a bank run, it might be 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years away, the system crashes, people are thrown out of work, we're in a great depression for 5 years, and we say, well, at least we won't put money in the bank, isn't that great? And everyone looks and says, who do we lynch? That bloke Page over there, he was the guy who suggested the idea. So that's why I kind of come down to you on an ideological level, actually I've got a lot of sympathy for your idea, right? The problem with moral hazard is that it's an intellectual idea that doesn't in reality mean there is a less, that means make that the less, sorry again, make that the worst outcome or a worse outcome. Mm. We have a better outcome today than in the scenario you suggest, in my view. You could disagree completely if you want, but I reckon if we have both systems running concurrently, your system is ideologically pure, but you know, it's your joke about Windows, right? Bill Gates says, if I had a car to go 400 miles an hour and, you know, it cost a third of the price, and the GM guy says, yeah, but it'd crash every 6 months and need entire rebuilding, right? Mm. So that's kind of the idea of like, you know, would it be a better system while it works? Yeah. As soon as it falls over, how many people do we want to throw out of work? How many businesses fail? What does it do to our standard of living? Is that the price for not being forced to put money in the bank? Okay, I can choose that. Or I can choose the option where it's, air quotes, forced to put money in the bank. I happily do it, by the way. The government will backstop me. That's the system works. It results in a greater standard of living, much more prosperity. I'm taking that system every day. Like, it's imperfect, and we should fix the regulation which makes the bank runs less likely and all that kind of stuff. I completely 100% agree with you, mate.
Yeah. But your assumption in all of that is that in the world that I describe, banks would continue to run with extremely poor risk management, lax legislation. Trump rolled back a whole bunch of rules that would have prevented what happened with SVB. So I would say, to your point, I hear what you're saying, but you're looking at it through the lens of the current system. If we had it's never going to happen, right? So this is pure.
I know, it's all on the drawing board.
It's all on the drawing board. But if it did happen, I think that if there was a bank that got themselves into trouble and collapsed and deposited lost them, it would be far less of a contagion effect because in that world, banks are running with a far, far higher degree of prudence. And it'd be
because
like—
there's no ability to do that. You can't have a fractional lending system and do that because you can't ever have enough cash on hand. Because when the bank run, to your point, as soon as there's an alternative, right? That's why they had to say.
But the bank runs. Why am I rushing to take my money out of CBA if I have extreme confidence and?
But no one does, mate.
I can see that they're matched up in terms of their duration, their hedging, and all of that kind of stuff. It's just like
because you're not the average depositor. Everyone else who's depositing money with CBA in that scenario goes, it's probably okay, but just in case. I'll take, why would you not take, if you had the option, if you knew there was a, if bank run, SVB starts, right? Mm-hmm. You got Commonwealth Bank, you go, oh bugger, this is not backstopped by the government. It's never going to be backstopped by the government. They've said explicitly, we won't bail you out, you're screwed. And you see SVB fail. You're like, oh, I should leave my money there for another week. Just it's probably okay. Or you say, I can move it to, what was the name of your bank? The one that sounds like the-
Custodia.
Custodia there. I'm going to move to Custodia because I can, it cost free just in case.
Yeah.
There is no world in which that doesn't cause CBA to crash. There is zero, because it's, even if you believe it's fine, even if you've done the work, I haven't, and your mate hasn't, and my mate hasn't, and there's enough of those who go, oh, just in case. I understand what you're saying, and intellectually I completely agree. I think pragmatically, there is no world in which 75% of banks survive the next bank run. If there is no backstop. That's the world that we're in, the interlinked world we're in now. Mm-hmm. We'll get to Credit Suisse in a minute. Credit Suisse is having problems now in part because people's faith in banks have been shaken further than they were.
Yeah.
And now people are re-evaluating the risk they're taking having their money in Credit Suisse. And that's with it in a world where they're going to be backstopped, right? Credit Suisse is going to be saved in some way, shape or form because otherwise we have the next GFC. Mm-hmm. So even with that, you know, I just don't see a scenario in which we don't have 90% of money all of a sudden turning up in Custodia, and 75% of banks fail, and we get into a 5-year effectively depression. Like, it's worse than a recession, right? It's just like, until we rebuild the system, we're screwed.
Yeah,
so it's almost baked beans and guns. Like, I don't have any issue with the ideology behind your thought.
Yeah.
I just don't see how it practically actually works without destroying the system. I just don't.
So,
it means that we're
left with a system that's only as strong as its weakest link. So
the
first, any kind of significant bank that gets into trouble, that's going to ripple through. That's the end.
Yes.
And when that happens, gun to the head, when I say we, society, civilization, bails the bad actors out, right? Yes.
And my argument is that it's still less worse. We should fix it, which is, we're going to regulation, but we should fix it so it happens less often. It's not as severe.
Well, we do. Yes. We fix it every crisis, only to roll them back and then go through it all again.
Correct.
So,
but it's still costing us much less. You could take every crash from 2000, pick a day, till today. The cost of that to society is still orders of magnitude less than letting the run continue. That's why we do it.
Yeah. I just think that we...
I know you don't like it, but I don't know. Do you honestly think that would end up... Would we be more prosperous in 2022 had the system come in 2020?
I think there is a massive benefit to society to have a much more robust and safe financial system.
One that is
sort of pyramided up on all kinds of counterparty risks across the spectrum. It's like a tinder dry scrub, and one spark somewhere is going to set the whole thing on fire. Yes. And you know, it's sort of except
that the firefighters are there, right? So we pay for the firefighters so that we don't have to raise the, you know, empty the field.
We're both coming back towards regulation. We should get to it. But I do want to make the point here, and I want to be very clear, use the crypto word here and not the B word. But everything that happened with Luna and all of these crypto scams was that they were offering 20% yields on these products. And at the time, the meme that was going around from the Bitcoiners and others who knew what was going on was that if you're earning yield,
you're
the product, right? Yes. In a lot of ways. And we all laughed at it. They might have been using funny internet tokens to do their thing, but we're using funny Fed tokens to do it here. It's the same thing. You're an investor, and I say, I've got 100 grand here. I need to put it somewhere. Commonwealth Bank, I can throw it over there, get probably 0.5% in a savings account. And I say to you, no, Scott, lend it to Page Bank. I've just set up shop. I'm going to give you 20% deposit. Now, which one do you take? At first, face value, it's like, well, obviously you take the 20%. Until you think, well, hang on. How are you taking my money?
What's being done with the money?
Giving me 20% back and still making it worth your while.
That's right.
It doesn't add up. It's an impossible kind of situation. Now, the yields in the real financial system aren't anywhere near that, but it's the same exact principle.
Yeah.
And again, I just stress the point. When you put your money at the bank, you are giving the bank a low interest rate loan.
Yes.
That's what you're doing. And just as if you are investing in emu farms or shares or anything like that, that investment, that loan, your asset, their liability has a counterparty risk. And whenever there's a counterparty risk, there is a risk that you could go down. And you take that risk happily because generally speaking, along the risk spectrum, it's not that much of a risk. And I get 2%, you know, or whatever it happens to be that they, well, I get less than that for a long time.
Turn deposit, I do okay, but exactly.
You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, it's, I just want to stress that point. Let's bail everyone out. Now, if the taxpayer does it, well, when people say, oh, the government's going to bail that out, the government is us. Like that's where the money, they either poof the money into existence or they borrow it from us, or they don't borrow it, they take it from us, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's bad and tax is theft. I'm not going down that line because I don't agree with it. I'm very happy to pay tax for the, I'm not a libertarian. By the way, one of the funniest things of this whole incident was all the libertarian VCs going, we need a bailout.
That's so true.
Dudes, you were very strongly against any kind of government intervention except when it suits you, and all of a sudden you're
you know,
very-
that, you know, they say, mate. It's a con unless you're on it.
Absolutely. So anyway, it's there is a cost. Now look, let's get to the solution very quickly.
Yes, let's do that.
So what the Fed? I forget the name of all the Fed. Yes, thank you. All the different bodies. So
Federal at the moment, Deposit Insurance Corporation, for those who are wondering.
Thank you. And so the way that they do that deposit guarantee is they charge a premium, an insurance premium to all the banks in the system. Yep. And that's what funds it. I think it's $100 billion or something there at the moment, not nearly enough to cover everything. And so they said, Biden said when he made, by the way, you know, the president's making a special press announcement. That's another thing. It's like, now I'm worried. You know, it's like the bank CEO says, don't panic. I wasn't, but now that's I'm right. going to. That's oh, right. The president's saying we've got a strong financial system. Okay,
that's the footy version of the club chairman saying we've got full confidence in the coach. Like, oh, he's obviously gone.
He's gone.
He's on seek right now.
Oh, mate. So they said actually we're going to deposit. We're going to guarantee every deposit. It could be $10 billion. You get your money will be there and it will be available. Taxpayer is not going to pay. Like, well, that's good because that would suck. Why are my taxes going to bail out these bad actors and people who took silly risks? The banks will pay, reading between the lines here, we're just going to charge them a bigger premium.
Yes,
now, I would sort of say poo rolls downhill, as they say. And what that means is that, here's other second and third order effects that I don't know if getting quite enough attention. What are the banks going to do in response to that? Do you think they're likely to absorb that cost themselves, or do you think that they'll pass on whatever they can? What do you think it does to their cost of doing business and their returns on equity? Yep. It changes the maths of the entire situation. So this is kind of unprecedented in a way to this magnitude. Here's what's also interesting. They also said, tell you what, we'll give you a loan. We're only going to charge you 0.1% above the official cash rate. So it's a super cheap loan. And as collateral, you can lodge all of this paper that they call it, these bonds, as collateral. Not at what they're worth, according to the market. They're now $60 today, whereas $100. Yeah, we will lend it to you what they call at par. So you've got this bond.
Which is the face value of the bond.
Yeah. Massively impaired. It's not coming back anytime soon unless you want to wait 10 years for it to mature, right? Mm-hmm. And we're going to lend it to you at the full face value. So in a way, irony of ironies, did the Fed ever lower interest rates? I mean, sorry, did the Fed ever increase interest rates if they're allowing people to borrow against it at par? You could arguably say no. They're undermining that. They've gone to this massive effort to tighten the financial settings to fight inflation. Mm. And in a pen stroke, they've walked back that significantly and again, they had to do something. So, you know, it's not
going to be too.
But there are now every bank is like, I'm fully backstopped. Oh, these losses that are very real are actually no longer real. And, oh, okay. Now, does that encourage less risky or more risky behavior?
So
that's the point. And now when you see Credit Suisse, Swiss.
Ah, you know. Potato.
I really should know after 22 years.
It looks
years
the same right now. I'm going to say Swiss, but I've always got Credit Suisse. But
I've heard it said both ways.
Probably, yeah. Go on.
Depends what accent, I suppose. You think Swiss accent, it could
let's
be.
Let's all start doing accents.
Let's avoid that. This is a major bank, a Swiss bank, and they're basically getting into the same similar related issues. At a point, the insurance scheme is not going to cover. Well, this is a Swiss bank as well. So there's all kinds of contagions. Someone has to pay the piper. Now, this isn't nice. This isn't a good reality. It's not always a fair reality, and we can decide on how we want to make it. But someone's paying the piper here.
Yes, correct. And my argument is the price is worth paying for the benefit we get the rest of the time. That's a different
story. Well, I think this is where we agree. So what you're saying, and this is the far more pragmatic and realistic solution, is okay, bail you out. I think what we would stress as strongly as we can is let's bail the buggers out if we have to, because there's a gun held to our head.
And fix it once and for all.
Yeah, but let's put some proper regulations in. Yeah. What Trump did, and I'm not even trying to be political here, just as an idiotic move beyond the idiocy. He rolled back all of these rules that would have had it. So there are rules for a reason. If you get to operate a business in a systemically
crucial, Yeah, we've decided these things are too big to fail.
You're a fundamental part of the economy and we can't afford you to fail. Yes. So, okay, if you want to run in that business, that's fine, but there are massive, massive amounts of red tape. Don't do it if you don't want to do it. But if you are going to do it, you're going to run with the highest degree of safety. And you know what? That's going to make banks a lot less profitable. Boo-hoo. Boo-bloody-hoo, right? But if if you don't get to make these egregious profits and have that implicit backstop. If you get that backstop, it comes with conditions and they need to be rock solid.
Yep.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
So, a couple of things, mate. I've said this before on the podcast, and I don't know if we disagree, we're just different explanations, but we're not bailing out those who made bad decisions, right, or took silly risks. And this is why regulation, by the way, back to your point, is so dramatically important. I'm listening to a book at the moment called The University of Berkshire Hathaway. I don't know if I mentioned this on the pod last week.
You mentioned it to me, I think.
Yeah. And they talk about, Buffett talks about running the business of Berkshire Hathaway such that he's never going to be relying on the kindness of strangers. He's the chief risk officer and he's going to be there. He's drawing, painting his masterpiece for not only his own lifetime, but for decades and decades hence. And so he's running a business as the major shareholder, or the largest shareholder, running the business in exactly the way he would want it run if he owned the business. When we end up with professional, air quotes, managers, a phrase that you introduced me 2 years ago, which I love, that idea of, the professional manager who says, well, I'm here for the paycheck. I am going to do whatever I need to do to get my paycheck in 3 or 4 years. I'll be out of here, particularly a big bank if you're running that thing, or you even in major senior ranks, right? Like the incentives are all for making bad, risky decisions, hoping you're right. And if you're wrong, hoping you're gone by then. And even if you get caught, you say, well, it was still worth the risk. I could have made $20 million. If it doesn't work out, I get nothing. I don't get less than nothing because no one comes and takes my house off me. So that's still a very good bet. You make that bet every day of the week because you're not responsible for it. And when we talk about, this is my only kind of ranty stuff. We talk about bailing out the banks. We then say we're bailing out the banks because the banks made silly decisions and did stupid things. And I think that inadvertently confuses the owners and the managers because, the shareholders are screwed. We're not bailing out the share. SVB shareholders will have almost entirely exactly zero when this is finished. The execs have lost their jobs. So do we bail out the bank?
Oh, boo-hoo. By the way, they should have much more. Like, I think that you want to fix something. When you start putting like criminal penalties around this kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, when my downside is I get fired.
Totally. I'm not saying I feel sorry for them. My point is that we are not bailing out the execs and we're not bailing out the shareholders.
No.
So we bailing call it bailout. We say we bail out the bank. What we're doing is basically, bailing out depositors.
Yep.
And even then, mate, here's the other thing, right? So for all the FDIC stuff, we're not actually paying the depositors anything necessarily. Depending on if the full face and forth of force of the government / FDIC, US Fed, US Treasury, it's a lot of them all wrapped together, can actually mean that they can sell the full deposit book and the full loan book to somebody else. It's very possible, it's not really likely, but it's very possible the government actually won't spend a dollar to do this. And that's the benefit of the capital C confidence thing, right? Because all you say is, no, you'll get your money. And everyone goes, oh, okay, well, they don't take it out then. No, you don't. Cool. And the borrowers will still pay it back. Yeah, they'll still pay it back. Okay, cool. So then what? And effectively all you're doing is saying, and you're transferring the assets and the liabilities to another bank. As long as those assets and liabilities are and this is what I said before about it wasn't a question of the bank making bad loans. The assets of SVB were never at question. Again, there might be some failures in there, but as a group, were never in question. It was their ability to actually run the business and make money and avoid that bank run. So there may actually be zero payout from the FDIC because it may not need to pay anybody anything if it can find a buyer for the loan book and the deposit book because the only problem with it was the mismatch, the timing, the bank run itself was the problem. Nothing else was the problem. Now, the mark-to-market stuff, by the way, mate, I don't necessarily know. That was a rule that was brought in, I think it was post-GFC. I'm reasonably sure that was a mistake in terms of the way they do it for exactly this reason. You create artificial problems that actually don't exist if you hold to maturity. There's no reason they don't need to hold to maturity unless it's a bank run. So we're making them write down a value that frankly doesn't need to be written down for the sake of it. Unless there's a run, because you don't need the money. So at some point there is and that's part of the regulation change. I'd look at modifying. But I just want to say that because it's we say, oh, the FDIC is going to get this much money. They're going to have to spend all that money making the depositors whole. Not necessarily. If another bank buys the assets and liabilities of SVB, they'll probably get some sort of discount, so they'll probably pay something, the FDIC, to kind of, you know, oil the wheels. But if you're a bank, you're already operating on 2% margins. If you can buy the assets and liabilities of SVB at a 5% discount, you're going to do it every day of the week as long as you trust the value of those assets. So I just think we kind of need to be a little bit careful. We're not bailing out the bank. We're not bailing out the shareholders. We're not bailing out the execs, which is, back to your point, though, exactly why it's problematic. Because we've said this about CBA before and others. The shareholders of I don't know who owns SVB, actually, but let's assume it's a similar-ish shareholder base to the Commonwealth Bank. Well, let's make it out the Commonwealth Bank. If the head of the Commonwealth Bank does something really stupid and the bank goes broke, the government will, air quotes, bail out the bank, but it won't really, because the CEO loses his job, the shareholders lose their money. Shareholders don't want, at least if you ask them, whether they're complicit, it's an open question, I suppose, but they're not saying, can you please go and take risky bets just in case I get a bit extra? Because I'm not getting, you know, the bonus as a proportion of the time put into it. You know, if CBA CEO gets $20 million for a year's work, the ROI on that time is astronomical. If a CBA shareholder gets an extra 5% share price, I don't reckon anyone's saying, I take 5 if you take stupid risks, but 4.5 if you don't. People say, I'll take the 4.5, thanks very much. You know, I'm not gonna, as a shareholder, want you to do that. My issue is absolutely the regulation. It's absolutely the actions of the bank CEOs and senior staff. I don't think the bailout itself is necessarily the problem. I don't think, again, the shells don't get bailed out. So it's who gets bailed out? No one really. In fact, if it works properly, the assets get transferred because the FDIC says, if something goes wrong, we're here. It's like, oh, okay, good, we're done then. So I just want to make those points. I think they're important to think through how we change. Now, regulation-wise, we have, and by the way, I should say, the banks in Australia particularly, and certainly around the world for most of the world, are much better capitalized than in 07. Mm-hmm. The capital rules, they have been increased 3 times, I think we're up to Basel 3. So they're better than they were. They're still insufficient. And the risk management is still insufficient. And the regulator was probably asleep, or was, as you said, mate, because of the Trump changes. Basically, Trump raised the ceiling for the assets at which you're considered a systemically important bank with stronger regulation. Under the pre-Trump rules, SVB would have been required to do different things.
Yeah.
But he raised the ceiling. SVB, they fell under that ceiling. So now they don't have to do those things. That was probably a large part of what brought SVB undone. But that's the challenge. So
the banking lobby in Australia has been consistently pushing for similar. They're an interest group, right?
So absolutely. Yeah.
They're going to press for that. And the reason they do it is because there's more money to be made. But that money, the cost of that opportunity is greater systemic risk and all of those problems.
And who do you think they're trying to make money for? You reckon the banking lobby are trying to make money for the shareholders? Or you reckon they're trying to make money for the executives?
Because I think it's just, I mean, you know, you could explain it to a 12-year-old and they'll get it. I don't know what's so hard to understand here. But these things get through big because politicians, I guess. I don't know. It's madness. Absolute madness. Exactly. There's no adults in the room.
There's not.
I should say, credit where it's due. APRA did knock back a lot of these things. That's absolutely, I should be fair. And your point is that here's something let's be real for a second.
Okay.
This could in theory happen in Australia. Absolutely. It could happen tomorrow.
Yep.
I mean, there's nothing that can be done to stop it if we all
Particularly because all it would require is for us all to lose faith for any reason, real or imagined. Yep. If we all tomorrow said, Commonwealth Bank might go broke, I better take my money out. We all log on to internet banking and transfer our cash tomorrow.
Yep.
Commonwealth Bank is insolvent in half an hour.
Now, by the way, I've talked about this before. I last looked at the FY22 results. I use CBA because it's the strongest bank. By the way, if you'd held, why are banks considered such a great investment over the last 10 years? You have just been, even with dividends reinvested, I think the best you would have done was in CBA, which is about 8% total return compound. Yep. The others were 2%, 4%, one was -2%. It's just like what a woeful, massive underperformance, even with the yield.
The answer to your question, by the way, is because we learn lessons slowly and we change our minds slowly. Yeah. So
because of the decade before.
It's the echo of the 30 years that kind of finished in probably 2015-ish, I think.
Yeah, round about then. Yeah, it sort of had a hiccup, let's call it, during the GFC.
Raced back. Bounced back and exactly. Anyway, so I keep going.
I want to say this is going to happen. I'm just explaining the maths. And it worked out that if CBA took an impairment on 10% of its assets, and its assets being things like home loans, three-quarters of its book is home loans, residential home loans. So I can't do the exact math, but if all of those assets dropped by about 10%, they're insolvent. They've got more liabilities than that. And so there's another way that it can happen. So I'm just saying, I'm not saying this will happen or could happen or is likely to happen, but it can happen. Yeah. At the same time, the regulations, the buffers, the rules are much, much, much more strict here. So I do want to make that, I don't want to put the fear of God into people, but it just, I think that is a consequence of us not really having a recession in 30 odd years or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, is that we look at these institutions as rock solid, when in fact they are, as a business model, usually pretty damn cyclical. And as we've seen, at least on a global thing, like they fail very regularly.
Yeah.
So we have to be vigilant as a society. I think, you know, if we're going to, if we're going to have this devil's bargain where, you know, put your money with us because you have to, or, you know, get a shovel and a vault, you know, it is the very least we can do is have the absolute highest standards. If that means that the bank gets a return on equity of 4% or whatever, I'm cool with that. And I think we all need to be cool with that, right?
I agree. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, these things weren't traditionally super high returning asset businesses. They just weren't. I mean, back to the Medicis in Italy. These things, they're not super high yielding investments. They should be well run, safe businesses. And this is the other thing, and this is why regulation is so important, because there is no justifiable reason for the taxpayer slash the government to backstop in actual cash or confidence a badly run business, except that, in my view, there is no alternative. So if that's the reality, if that's the bargain we've made, if the bargain is we will never let a bank fail, then they're entitled to A, as your, to your point, be sufficiently capitalized, so it's really, really unlikely, and B, run the business such that it is not, it is, you know, very, 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 very well run, not making silly risks, making sure the record keeping and the management are up to date. From what I understand, the SVB stuff is just a straight out treasury management failure of just not matching things up. It's like, it's not even difficult. It's a Silicon Valley bank, which makes it sound sort of techie, right? This is just a allegedly badly, very badly run bank where they just simply went, that doesn't match that. Oh, never mind.
We'll be okay.
You know? Right. And it was just stupidity. And so they ran the thing badly. They made stupid decisions. I don't know why. I don't know what incentives were in place, to your point, mate, or just straight out wishful thinking, hoping, whatever else they are. But this is a situation, and the regulator I won't blame the regulator because I don't know whether they had the regulation to apply, but the combination of those things is the easiest thing in the world, right? It's just literally, they actually have to report to the RBA regularly on what they're doing, who they're lending to, how much they're lending, what their mismatches are, check the duration, check the asset quality. All the stuff that needs to be done is really, really important. I still will go back though, mate, to the point of, I think the mark-to-market accounting stuff doesn't necessarily, I think if we think about what the banks are, making the mark stuff to market artificially reduces, unless they are available for sale assets. But if available for sale, doesn't mean they're going to be sold. It's the old long-term, you know, current assets versus non-current assets, right? Just because they're a current asset doesn't mean they're going to be used up. It just means that, you know, they're available to be used. Assets held available for sale is one thing, but if you can get that back, forcing them to report lower. And again, this is a regulatory change. I think it's pretty sure it was GFC. Pre-GFC, they didn't have to do that. Now they do. So what changed in the way banks run? Nothing, except now it looks like it's worse temporarily. Makes the bank runs more likely because you force them to put out a financial statement which says, if I had to sell it now, I'd get 60 cents in the dollar. Are you going to? No, but if I did it, I'd get this. Well, then that doesn't seem, you know what I mean? Like it's,
well, they might have the intention not to, but they might be forced to because, say, depositors want their money back.
Which is the circle thing, right? Because they don't want their money back if the assets are okay. It was part of that mismatch where they went, oh, bugger, these don't match. I better get my money out now.
You're right. But there are other things outside of a bank run. You know, it could be investors chasing better yield elsewhere.
Yep.
It could be that I'm a startup that's got an app that does absolutely nothing and I've raised $10 billion in some ridiculous bubble of a VC spending orgy and I've got all of that money there. And guess what? Yes. I've gone out of business because no one wants to use my stupid app. And so then the deposits go away and get drawn down, just get bled out and get used. So there are things that can happen, not just because there's a bank run because people are nervous, just because people are just drawing on their money and taking it elsewhere, not for fear of collapse. But then you get that. That's really the very start of this story where these things started to sort of happen. And then people started to notice the mismatch. And then people started to notice that. And then that led to the bank run and that just threw fuel onto the fire.
Yes.
Let's look. The so what after all of that is, what do I do? What does it mean for the markets? So we should probably talk about that before we run out of time. I just wanted to sneak something in before we did. During a massive risk-off banking crisis, Bitcoin surged 30%. And you know why? Do you know why? So there's a few factors at play.
Because desperation is a wonderful thing if you have a speculative asset class.
Look, there's a lot of anecdote in this, okay. But there's a lot of irony of ironies. A year ago from today, if you were a corporation, you would have been safer putting your money in Bitcoin than a US 2-year bill. Just incorrect. As a fact, right?
Fundamentally incorrect.
What, even incorrect?
Safer?
Yeah.
Safer?
What, no. In what happened over the last year with those bonds versus what's happened with Bitcoin? One is
No. Safer. So in 2 years' time, you're going to get the face value back. You have no. That is. I'm going to assume you misspoke, Andrew Page.
No.
You get your absolute cash back in 2 years' time unless the US government fails.
No, I'm just making a statement of fact. I said, had you done that, you would have been in a better position. And by the way,
You said safer. Okay. I want to be really clear. You said you'd be safer.
You would have been better off.
That's true. That is absolutely true.
Okay, I'll clarify.
That's good. And, I'll let you know with safer.
And your money's there because it's full bearer backed.
Well, your tokens are there.
Yeah, they're absolutely there. And so what's happened is what's
sell them at the price.
I just want to make the point because it's fascinating. So again, you've got Silicon Valley customers here.
Yes,
they've gone now. Before this is it's kind of a lot of momentum is maintained, but before the big backstop of all the deposits, okay. Crap, we've got $20 million here. What do we do with it?
Yeah.
Let's put it in this thing. Okay, is it going to be volatile? Yeah. Are bonds volatile? Yeah, turns out extremely volatile. is there risk? Absolutely. But a lot of companies put money into that, not for speculative purposes, but for preservation of treasury purposes. And that is a fascinating turn of events.
Particularly in between the time at which SVB was going broke and the FDIC hadn't said they're going to cover all deposits. At that point, you're like, hey, up to 250, I'm covered, I'm good. Yep. Up after that, I'm going to get somewhere between 0 and 100% of my money back.
Yep.
And so at some point, you make the speculation of, it's a bit, it goes back to a kind of bank run. What's that bloody thing? I keep dropping out of my
head. A wonderful life.
Custodia.
Yeah.
You kind of go, okay, well, where else can I put it just in case? And you're absolutely, it makes perfect sense to me that between, now, at this
Isn't point, that fascinating though? Isn't that? Yes. I mean, isn't, I don't want to make any, all my only point is, is that the fact that more than a fringe element of this cohort thought that was a good idea is a noteworthy and almost potentially historical moment because that was something that would not even be considered a few years ago.
Correct.
And it's noteworthy. It's a loss.
You mentioned internet banking, right? And how quick a bank run can be. I think it's a function of that because the old bank run would have been go to the branch, stand in line with a whole lot of people. Northern Rock. So back in the internet.
Oh, in the UK.
Yeah. They had lines out this phase. Greece, same thing. Lines out the door. People trying to get their money out of these things. Mm-hmm. Because they're limited, by the way. You can still do that on the internet banking. So there is a chance the bank says, actually, you can use internet banking, but you can only take $100 out at a time or whatever. So those things are also real. I think in terms of the opportunity, A, internet banking, B, it's a digital currency you can buy in an instant.
Yeah.
So there's a whole lot of, I absolutely get why you would. You know, in the old days, it might have been take the money out, put it in the backyard, or take the money out, go and buy treasury bonds over the counter at the local government office or whatever. The sheer process, even these days, can you buy treasury bonds online? Probably. I don't really know the process, but if you could literally go a quick, okay, press the button. Now, I personally, given the choice of buying a government bond or Bitcoin, I take the government bond because I know I get the money back. But leaving it in
might not that get the purchasing bank, power back, but you'll get the nominal value back. But continue.
But there's no downside risk to the nominal value at least, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas if you buy any asset, including not talking about Bitcoin, but you know, I could take my money out of SVB and bought CBA shares with it, or you know, Berkshire shares with it, and the same thing. There's room on both sides.
Yeah.
So it really depends on what you're looking for. But you're right at the point in time which you're like, I need to get this out now. What can I do? You can spin up a Bitcoin wallet in, I assume, a minute and a half.
Yep.
Throw the money in there. Maybe you lose 5, 10, 15%. Maybe you make 5, 10, 15%.
Yep.
Whatever range of outcomes you have there is unlikely to be as big as the range between 0 and 100 when it comes to the money that was, at that point, unsecured in the bank.
And frankly, with interest rates being as wild and crazy as they are, those kinds of swings are not inconceivable if you would opt for a treasury. Yeah. You know?
Absolutely, yes.
And so
if you wanted to redeem it, in the secondary market,
yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so it's again, just going back a little bit here, typically, because there's a lot of, during all that crypto nonsense, a lot of sort of hot Wall Street money and this kind of thing. So generally speaking, there's been a bit of an exaggerated, but nevertheless very real correlation between tech stocks, financial conditions with Bitcoin. It's just because people need something to look at when they gamble on this thing, because a lot of people just gambling right. with it.
Yes,
let's be honest about that. Yep. So if you had said, I think if you and I were chatting a week ago and said, what would happen if the 16th largest bank in the US was collapsed and Credit Suisse was on the verge of bank, and what do you think in that instance happens to Bitcoin? I think a lot of us would go, Even the diehard believers will go, well, look, the network survives and it's fine. But it's, man, you know, it's called risk off. They call it the risk off trade when everyone goes, ooh, it's scary, and we all take our money out. and so you would say, oh, Bitcoin drops 50% in that scenario.
Yep.
You don't go, it goes up 30%.
No, I think that's right, actually.
It's just whether that's right or wrong, I don't even want to get into it, but I just want to make the comment. It's like,
absolutely.
Huh. That's
and
interesting.
And what happens next is fascinating too, right? Because maybe it goes back, maybe it doesn't. These are break points in momentum in you know, where things change, maybe permanently or maybe not. Again, we don't know what happens next. Maybe this is the coming of age of Bitcoin, or maybe it's one of those. Huh, that was an interesting way to kind of just throw your money sideways, pull it back out, price goes back down again.
Yep.
We're back to where we were. It was a nice thing to have available. Yeah. But either way, to your point, the fact it happened and the fact it was an available alternative and potentially for a lot of these guys, a credible alternative. I do wonder, mate, for what it's worth, though.
Fascinating.
These were the tech bros. I do wonder what would have happened had it been the Wachovia Bank of West Virginia.
Yes.
You know, I don't imagine there is the same propensity. There would definitely be some impact and some people would have taken that option for sure.
Yeah.
I'm making up names, of course, but, you know, it's one of those.
I'm careful not to. I just wanted to make the comment because it's sort of like, I remember when I saw it, I was not upset, but I was surprised. I was like, huh. Hey, because we're running out of time here
We ran out of time.
I've segued into Bitcoin. I'll pull myself back from that.
Go on.
You're an investor. In Australia, you've got a portfolio of shares and ETFs.
Yes.
This is happening. What do you do?
I've written about this and my answer was absolutely nothing, but I had the luxury of not owning bank shares. So I don't know.
By the way, just quick interjection. Yes. You said you timestamped it before the market had opened.
Oh, no. Go on.
So let's have a look. We've got
10:29 a.m.
Refresh. Where's my refresh button?
CBA shares. CBA shares are down 2%. Is what you're looking for?
Yeah. You know what? You know what I'm looking forward to?
What's that?
No financial journalist in the world is going to end the day going, CBA shares were off 1.95% today. They'll go, $13 billion wiped off.
All right. What do you do as an investor? I was never particularly worried about SVB even while over the weekend because for better or worse, and we've talked about better or worse. I think better, you think worse, but for better or worse. Mm-hmm. No, we don't actually.
No, I think in this instance, the way the world is, I think it is for better. They had to bail. Yeah.
So it was always going to happen. I mean, there was a chance it wouldn't have happened, but it was always going to happen.
Yep.
So, you know, was I worried about contagion? I still am a little bit because we've seen what happens if you lose trust. And that trust and confidence can be supported by regulators, but can't be ever forced by regulators. You can do everything you can to say, it's okay, we're here, daddy's here, you know, off you go, back to sleep. you know, they've said that, and that probably works. No guarantee, but probably works. I have said a lot that I don't think people are taking good risks being overexposed to banks. You've said that too, probably in more forceful terms. Mm-hmm. I think if you have banks in your portfolio, you should be really carefully thinking about how much exposure you have to
but the dividend yield, Scott. About. The dividend yield. This is always the retort I get. It's like, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I get a great dividend. It's like,
and knock yourself out. If you want to chase that dividend yield for the potential downsides. And remember, this is what I really want to be really clear about. SVB depositors and lenders are fine. The financial system is fine. SVB shareholders have precisely a donut, right? They've got nothing. Now, maybe they get cents in the dollar back because maybe they find a buyer and there's excess capital or something. There's probably not, but maybe there is. So I don't want to say it's exactly zero, but the bank will not bail you out. The bank will bail out the depositors and lenders. That's why I made the point before. It was partly about the system and partly about the actions. But if you're a bank shareholder, don't think a bailout means you're okay. A bailout means you're gone. Mm. In Lloyd's in the UK, we talk about Northern Rock, The UK government bought acquired 90% of Lloyd's. Now, you still got a tenth of your money left over, but if you're your $93 Commonwealth Bank shares to be worth $9.30, well, that's what happens if someone else acquires 90% of your bank.
So actually, mate, it doesn't even, just, sorry to interrupt, but it doesn't even have, there's a spectrum here, right? So let's talk fact in recent history. When the GFC happened, CBA issued, increased its shares outstanding by 20%. Now, as everyone knows, in Australia, we avoided a recession. In Australia, we didn't have a calamity. I mean, there was exposure. This is a global sort of contagion event. But relatively, we were okay. So it was a moderate impact to have been a disastrous impact.
Yep, correct.
And despite it being only a relatively moderate impact, you still got diluted 20%.
Yeah, right, exactly. Now, so the so what for the investors is, despite that or after that, we've all done very well. So almost always, and like no guarantees, no promises, selling and panicking is a terrible idea, particularly after the fact which already priced in. You know, if I was an SWB shareholder, I could have panicked on Wednesday. I would have, because I would have sold my shares and made all my money. But you don't get to panic in advance. That's not how it works, right? So, you know, if you get out before anything happens, fine, fantastic. Generally speaking, so two things. One, you're not going to know in advance. So good luck with that. Second, the potential panics. So if you told every bank on whatever day it was, Monday, I think, Australian time, you know, would you have made or lost money over the next 12 months? I don't know. We don't know yet. We'll find out in 11 and a half months' time. Mm. But certainly for the rest of the market, you know, when Woolies shares falls 2% because some Silicon Valley bank goes broke, you're like, okay, that's just silly, right? People are just selling stuff because they're selling stuff. Mm. My general view is, A, the panics, the results of the panics are normally not as bad, and certainly over the long term, almost never as bad as you imagine. I would say actually almost exactly never, but no promises. But of every 10... panics that are expected, one might happen if you're lucky. So the other thing is, if you panic about a panic and you're wrong, then you've actually lost money as well. The market goes up over time. So as an investor, what did I do? What would I do? What should I do? Nothing. I did literally nothing. If I owned 60% of my portfolio on banks, I would have lightened very quickly. Thank you very much. But I don't, so I didn't.
A lot of people are doing that this morning, mate. A lot of people
They should be. They absolutely should be. It's madness to be exposed to a single sector with a single risk, with more than a certain proportion of your portfolio. And just because you own four banks doesn't make you diversified four ways.
No,
right?
You're not diversified in the slightest.
I mean, you might be. Only one of them might go broke. So you might if you're going to have 60% of your portfolio in banks, at least have four rather than one. That's true. Mm. But don't pretend that gives you some sort of fancy extra diversification that diversifies away the risk.
Mm-hmm.
If I had more than 10% of my portfolio in the banks, I'd be uncomfortable. If it was more than 20%, I'd be very, very nervous. Mm. Not because I expect anything. Same with anything, by the way. Like almost anything. I own Berkshire is a big chunk of my portfolio. So Sol Pats. So I'm not gonna pretend I'm you know particularly clean on this one. But I don't want 10% of my portfolio in any industry, any company that's not just one of those absolute bulletproof, rock solid businesses. And even then, is there a chance Berkshire has a problem? Yeah, Sol Pats. Yeah, I suppose. So you know maybe I'm kidding myself, but definitely not. A single, I don't want all, you know, 10% mining, I don't want 10% banks, I don't want 10% anything. Mm. But certainly not more than that. Definitely not more than that.
I think the point to make is that stance that you outlined was true before all of this anyway. Mm. So it's not necessarily a reactionary.
Just a reminder,
stance.
Hopefully.
Yes. It's not. I think you said before, we can't know what's going to happen, and you're right. Yeah. So I don't think either of us were sort of saying, get the hell out of the banks because they're about to collapse or anything like that, or that they could.
Yeah.
I think for me, and again, even taken outside of this, it's just, you know, we could almost have a drinking game around me saying the word asymmetry. But you can't know the future. You can make an educated guess, and you need to at a point. But when you have a scenario, and this is where it's sort of been my refrain with the banks in recent times, is that if everything goes ahead, and nothing disastrous happens, I might, with dividends and franking credits, get close-ish to a 10% annual return, something around that. In fact, it's probably a little bit lower, you know, depending on how ambitious you wanted to be on some growth assumptions, but just extrapolating long-term average, very highly mature businesses, you know, there's not a lot of area to grow into.
So very mature business, very mature category.
Never going to grow that fast. They're just not going to, they're going to be around, hopefully, but they're not going to grow that much. And that's fine. Yep. But I think too often investors, whether it's a bank or whether it's a small cap startup tech stock or whatever it happens to be, where you look at oh, what could I get? You also have to contrast that with what could go wrong. Yes. And when you have a scenario where it's like everything goes okay and all settled, told I get maybe 8% annualized return. If things do go wrong, I don't think it's likely, but they could go wrong, and I'm down 30%, it's just a really ordinary bet. I want a bet where if I'm wrong, it's just like, oh, I'm going to lose a little bit of money because I was wrong, but I don't get wiped out. But if I'm right, I want much, much, much more upside. I'm basically trying to flip loaded coins here rather than flip coins that are 50-50 or even worse in the case of some of the banks here. Because again, if you, let's you know, that you need to have a bit of humility here. The best analysis, the best spreadsheets in the world, you're not going to be able to know, but at least you want the spread of possibilities to skew in your favor. And I think for too long people, and this has been the story of the last 10 years, as I said, that the returns for bank shareholders have been woeful. The banks have not gone under. There's not been any major problems. They've still been paying all of their dividends. But it's kind of like in that environment where things have, you know, been okay, I've still gotten a worse return than I would have in an ING savings account in some instances, you know? So it's just a very unappealing bet. Does that mean that either of us would never touch a bank share? No. You know what you do? If there is ever kind of there's blood on the streets here and they're recapitalizing, I'd be backing up the truck because I know they're going to be bailed out. I know I'm not going to suffer the dilution. Oh,
I'm going to say I wouldn't assume they're going to be bailed out from a shareholder's perspective. I hear you. I think they'll be backstopped to some degree, but if it comes to a bailout, I think you as a shareholder.
Sorry. So they've announced the capital raise and it's going. So in other words, this is what happened to GFC. Here's our problem. We're doing this through it, and people aren't going, no thanks, and we're in trouble. They're going, okay, we'll go ahead.
Take my money.
The institutional raise has been. So I'm talking very deliberately here at a point where it's kind of like, we're impaired, we're taking a loss, we need more capital, but we're around. What do you have in that environment? You have an extreme drop in profits and you have the extreme drop in the market multiple that people are prepared to pay. But when you look ahead 5 years, you go, well, they're not going out of business. I'm getting to buy. This, what was the lesson of the GFC? When the banks were in 2008, buy the buddy banks, because that was, you know, you don't have to wait necessarily for that kind of a fat pitch, but I would be very tempted when that happened. And I'd certainly be much more interested if I felt as though just the general skew of possibilities was just like, well, heads I win and I might get a 15% annualized return. Tails, I might only lose 10%. Something like that becomes a lot more interesting, but it's just not there yet. But it's cool. It's there. I'm aware of it. And one day, I don't know when, I might get the chance. And when I do, I'll act there. And in the meantime, a lot of better opportunities in my mind.
Okay. We are miles over time. And at this point, I don't care because if you're still here, you're still listening. So let's keep going. Let's push through. Only to ask you rhetorically, because you've made your point very clear. ANZ is on a PE of 9.9 times earnings, and an earnings level that has been not growing at all, but, well, a little bit, but really consistent over the last, trying to find a number.
Consistently crap. Yes, that's true.
Well, that's my point, right? So my point is it's not, it doesn't seem to be an unusually elevated, cyclically elevated level of earnings.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a DCF would say a non-growth business, you could pay, is it like 12 times, I think, earnings? And get an okay
something
return.
Like that, yep.
So I'm buying, I could be buying NAB for 9.9 times earnings. Those earnings are about, you know, they're not cyclically high earnings. They're paying a 6.5% fully franked dividend yield. I am not buying the shares. I'm not asking you to talk me out of it. I am, though, going to ask a little bit rhetorically, dude, like, I know you want a better price. Maybe you get a better price or maybe you don't. But at 9.9 times very, very modest earnings, historically speaking, how much better does it need to get before? I mean, over the long term, the banks have been over the last decade or so, the banks have been a poor investment.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because I started a PE that was too high. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's, you know, it's, we've got to separate the share price from the bank performance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, dude. I'm not sure it's such terrible value at this sort of level.
Yeah, it's definitely better value than it was after what's happened with the share price. I mean,
versus the market. Does it not beat the market from 9.9 times a very flat level of earnings?
Well, it is appealing. The core part of the underpinning of that view, though, is that earnings will be flat. So there is a potential for earnings to take a whack because they have to take impairments on their assets because they lose deposit. You know, again, I'm not saying it's disaster kind of stuff, but if even if just the general, you know, I think pretty much I can't think of a single analyst or economist who doesn't think the US is probably likely in for a recession at some point. This happens. It just, as I said, the nature of these business models is intrinsically cyclical. And the nature of the Australian banking sector more than most around the world is that it's just purely about residential mortgages, right? So this is where my bias is going to be not so subtly revealed, is that if I thought that earnings were stable from here, I'm interested, you know, because not only is the PE relatively low, but what is it? The yield is 6.5% fully franked. So gross that up with some franking credits. I'm almost getting 10% just on the dividends. Everything else is a free kick. As you said, there's probably not much growth. Maybe multiples go up to 12. It's a decent proposition, but it's not a decent proposition if you feel as though earnings will be under pressure. Interestingly enough, just looking at the screen now, I don't think these are probably not, everything's happening in real time here and very fast. Right. So the forecasts I'm looking at are probably for at least from a week or so ago. But all of the people who follow this, and it's just a scientific fact that analysts tend to be more biased to the positive. It's like you said the other day, there's literally like two sell recommendations across all of the sell side broker space. But they're calling essentially earnings flat. And that was with a reasonable recovery narrative underpinning it. And so I just don't see the appeal for me.
Is there not a chance though? So I wouldn't need to finish this podcast, but at this point I don't care anymore. I just want to finish it out. Isn't there a chance the others, you're talking about, you're sort of showing your bias. Isn't there a chance that higher rates actually do increase net interest margins and that the downside is not as bad as it might seem? And in fact, in 2 years' time, profits are meaningfully higher than the current point. And, you know, at that point, the market says, actually, I'll pay 15 times earnings for NAB or for ANZ. So you've got profits that are 15% higher. The PE has gone up by 50%. You're probably going to make an 80% gain in a couple of years. Okay, I'm not trying to speculate just now.
You're painting a perfectly plausible scenario. So I'm not saying that's definitely not going to happen. I'm not that silly. It's definitely plausible. But what I'm painting out is sort of equally plausible. And
I absolutely agree.
My fundamental basis for investing is I need to have a degree of conviction of one outcome over the other. As I said, I'll explore the spread. What's the possibilities? Yep. And I want it to skew in my favor, but I also want to have some conviction that I feel for whatever reason, right or wrong, that it is actually going to be one of the favorable scenarios. So I'm not saying it definitely won't be good. I'm saying me with my very limited capacity intellectually, because it's not that great. I just, when you ask me what's the outcome for ANZ's earnings over the next 3 to 5 years, no idea. And I think if I paint out possibilities, there's a lot of nasty possibilities that I can't handicap with decent odds. And so what do you do in that situation, whether it's a bank or anything? I put it in the too hard basket and I move on and I find something that I can at least have conviction in. So that's how I think about it.
You know what I have conviction in?
Bitcoin.
Sunday's mailbag episode. Okay. Very special. Okay. Not Bitcoin. I'm gonna charge you. We're gonna set up a charity. You're gonna give money to charity. If you mention Bitcoin, just to get some good coming out of the fact that the crypto bros are talking about Bitcoin. I know it's very.
I'll donate a hundred sats for every time someone tags us with the hashtag of Bitcoin. How about that? You asked for it.
I'm very conflicted now because you're right. I want the donations. I really don't want a hashtag. All right, mate, will you come back Sunday?
Ah, man, I'm so looking forward to it. Yes.
See you then. Full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.